from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
There are over a half million women working in the fields of America. Most are undocumented immigrants. This is a story about the price many women pay to keep those jobs and to keep food on our table.
That's how a powerful new film airing tonight on KQED9 begins. It documents the story of the undocumented, women who work the fields and silently endure sexual abuse because speaking out means going public, and going public leads to deportation. We'll take up the story of rape in the fields next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Tonight at 10 o'clock, KQED 9 broadcasts Rape in the Fields, a powerful portrait of a dark side of America's farmlands, the vulnerability of the women who work the fields to sexual harassment and abuse. It's a story about what happens when power takes advantage of fear. In this case, the power of field supervisors who know that the women in their charge fear losing their jobs and deportation, perhaps more than anything else. This is also a story that hasn't received a lot of attention, in part because it is so hard to document. The fear that keeps women silent in the face of abuse has also kept this story from being fully told. In this hour of Forum, we preview the film and explore the problem that it exposes. Rape in the Fields is a collaboration of Frontline, Univision, where it airs on Saturday night, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We're joined by Andres Cedilla, producer of the English language version of Rape in the Fields for Frontline. He also works at the UC Berkeley's investigative reporting program. Andres, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us as well is Bernice Uhring. She is a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. She spent a year on this project interviewing workers and wrote the print stories that pertain to this story as well. She's also worked as a co-author with Grace Rubenstein and focused much of her reporting on the cases in California, Oregon, and Washington State, some of which are included in the film. We should also mention, by the way, that KQED's California Report will be airing a four-part series on this topic starting tomorrow. Andres Cedilla, as you went about documenting this story, what did it take to tell the story? Because it's a story in so many ways that begins with silence. So how did you crack that open?
Well, it took a long time to do this story. It took us at least a year of reporting and investigating, and it was a large collaboration, as you mentioned, between Frontline, Univision, the Center for Investigative Reporting. It took a lot of time and resources to be able to not only travel across the country and go into these farming communities and look for the women to have them tell them stories, but also to have the time to be able to gain their trust. I mean, this is an issue. We're talking about sexual assault. People don't want to talk about this in general. The women don't want to come forward. They're afraid of being deported. They may or may not speak the language. They're afraid of losing their jobs. So for that reason, they don't want to tell their story to the authorities, to their families, to anybody. And here we come asking them to tell it on national television. So it really just took a lot of time and resources and support from different organizations to get out there and do the work.
So this is an issue, Bernice Uhring, that is always difficult to talk about. But it's compounded in this case because talking about it brings about a fate that is perhaps even worse than experiencing sexual assault.
That's right. There are just such a constellation of barriers to why these women don't come forward to law enforcement, to their employers. And we face all of those as reporters seeking out these stories. But, you know, there are issues of immigration status that create a threat of deportation. I think what was very interesting for us to hear was that the threat of losing a job was almost one of the biggest barriers, because here they were sometimes a primary breadwinner for the family, and this was their entire livelihood. Stepping forward and making a claim could eviscerate all of that.
So, it sounds so, it sounds wrong in a way to say that deportation for them is a fate worse than rape. But is that indeed how many of these women saw that?
It did seem that they were willing to tolerate a great deal, deal that I think, obviously should not be tolerated, because the economic tenuousness of their existence was so great. Their concern for their families and the livelihood of the people that they were supporting was so tremendous that they bore that burden.
Let's hear just a short excerpt from the early in the program. This is Dolores Huerta, the famous co-founder of the United Farm Workers. You'll hear her voice first, and then you'll hear the voice of Bill Tamayo, who is an attorney with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, and who will also join our conversation a little bit. But just to set the stage and describe a little bit of what this problem is like.
Harassment is part of the job, so to speak. Women are looked at as sex objects when they're out there in the field. Sexual harassment is an epidemic in the fields, and it again goes back to the vulnerability that women have, the farm worker women have. They work in isolated places. Many of them don't speak English. A lot of them don't even know the laws. They don't even know that they can report sexual harassment and that the employer can be responsible for that. And so they feel helpless.
They refer to the fields as the Green Motel, because it was where they had to go and have sex with a hiring official. My initial reaction was asking myself, wow, over a century after slavery had ended, why do we still have these conditions in the fields?
Bill Tamayo, attorney with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, who will join our program in just a bit. It's such a striking image, the Green Motel, Andres Cedilla. And yet it's so difficult to know what happens in that Green Motel. Do we really know? Were you able to come to a real sense of how frequent this crime takes place?
Well, that's the trick, is that we really don't know. I mean, there are no statistics that are tracking what's going on in terms of sexual assault in the fields. On a very basic level, we don't know how many undocumented workers are working in this country. We don't know how many of them are women. And then you compound that with the fact that sexual assault is largely an unreported crime. The Department of Justice estimates that 2/3 of sexual assaults are never reported. And that's when you're talking about English-speaking women who have access to legal recourse. Here we're talking about a disempowered community, isolated in rural areas, sometimes don't even speak Spanish, and have a lot of shame. So we don't have statistics to show us how big a problem it is. But I can tell you, based on our reporting and having traveled to farming communities across the country, when we speak to women, they say it's happening to them, and it's happening to everywhere. And everywhere we went, we got the same story.
And as reporters, how do you wind up assessing and determining the credibility of those stories? Did you come down in the end on saying what they're saying is true?
Well, I think that what is challenging about these cases is that they are he said, she said cases,
yeah.
Classic he said, she said cases. But I think, on the other hand, when you start to look at a case from various angles and you start to speak to a number of different people working in the same setting and they say the same thing, and not only is that true within a specific company, but you start to see similar patterns of practice and behavior and exploitation in different companies across the country, you start to think that there's got to be some grain of truth to what is being reported here by these women.
Where did you come down on that, Andres, in terms of how you made your own determination about, yes, this is a credible source, I'm going to put this person on the air?
I mean, you have to take each case on a case-by-case basis. I remember speaking with an advocate who spent a lot of time with women assessing their stories, and one of the things that he used as a barometer was trying to figure out what did this woman have to gain by telling the story and what did she have to lose. And in most cases, they had everything to lose.
Yeah.
Their reputation, their jobs, they could be deported. They've sacrificed everything to come to this country, often left their children behind, gone into debt to work excruciatingly long hours in hard conditions. They've done everything to just come here and work, and they're willing to give that all up to make a claim against a supervisor. So then once you weigh that about what they can potentially gain, in most cases, these women don't even receive any kind of financial reward at all. So it's you have to take each case on a case-by-case basis. But as Bernice was saying, when you see the pattern everywhere and you hear people saying it all the time, you start to wonder what's really going on.
Andres Sedilla and Bernice Uhring joining us. They were part of the reporting team that produced the documentary Rape in the Fields, which airs tonight at 10 o'clock on KQED 9, 7 o'clock on Univision on Saturday. Play another short clip from the film. This has to do with a case of the DeCoster egg case. Set the stage for us, will you? We're going to join the clip a little bit into the story, and I'll set that up as we go to it. But describe the basics of the case.
DeCoster was a family business where they had large egg operations around the country that had been cited multiple times by different agencies for OSHA violations. And more recently, they were found culpable in one of the biggest salmonella outbreaks in the country. And during the different investigations by different federal agencies, including immigration, they found a whole host of undocumented workers there. And through that investigation, they started to realize it came to light that there was also serial sexual assault going on in the plants.
So we'll listen now to a short excerpt from this story. The voices you hear will be first Sheriff Paul Schultz, who describes what is going on at the plant. Whenever the plant felt like there might be some sort of immigration investigation, they would sort of lock things down so that people wouldn't be aware of who was actually there. And then later in the clip, you'll hear the voice of a high school teacher by the name of Berta Alberts, I believe, who was suspicious about what was going on. Let's hear this clip.
When immigration patrols reached Wright County, DeCoster managers took steps to hide their illegal workforce.
If they would hear of an immigration vehicle being around the area, they would lock the doors of the plant or post people at the exits of the plant so the people could not leave.
DeCoster's supervisors locked up the workers for days on end, and people in the community began to notice.
One young lady, she said, her parents haven't been home for 3 days. They went to work and they never came back. And I asked them, well, where are they? And she said, well, I am communicating with my mom on the phone. They're at the plants, sleeping in cardboard boxes, and they've been feeding them scrambled eggs.
Workers had been calling their families, saying they couldn't leave. Alberts took matters into her own hands, confronting the plant manager.
I said, I came to pick up the women, and if you don't shut those machines off, I'm calling the police. So he shut the machines off, and I told the girls, let's go. And they walked out, and I piled them in my van. And I think that I built this trust with them that I can help them.
It was this trust that would unlock DeCoster's deepest secret.
An excerpt from Rape in the Fields. The correspondent for that story, whose voice you also heard in that piece, is Lowell Bergman. It's an astonishing and dark story at so many levels, and it raises this question also of the difficulty of prosecuting these cases, because as we learn over the course of the film, Bernice Uhring, they don't wind up in criminal court. At best, sometimes the employers are taken to task, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But no one's found guilty ever, it seems like.
That's right. We looked at all of the federal civil sexual harassment cases filed against agricultural businesses since 1998, and not a single one of them led to a criminal prosecution. Now, there have been some criminal prosecutions with state cases, but this sample that we looked at, it was something that never went anywhere. I think what was interesting about DeCoster was that there's actually a criminal investigation. There was FBI involved. There was the local sheriff was involved. And even then, the county prosecutor declined to pursue the case.
And is that something you found nationwide, that there's great reluctance for criminal prosecution to take place?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to just the difficulty of prosecuting sexual assault crimes in general. There's often no witnesses. There's often no evidence. Rape kits aren't often performed. So it's very difficult to prosecute a sexual assault case in general. And so even in cases like DeCoster, where there was a criminal investigation, the county attorney simply decided there wasn't enough evidence to proceed, even though 11 women had come forward alleging that they had been sexually assaulted, you know, corroborating stories. And the sheriff believed. And we found other instances in which law enforcement, the district attorneys, believe the case, but it was very difficult to secure a criminal prosecution.
You saw in that case, in the DeCoster case, a somewhat reluctant, perhaps, but in the end determined sheriff who felt like this is something that he had to pay attention to, this sort of heroic teacher who said she was going to pay attention to this. Is that part of what you take from this story, that we just need to pay more attention?
Oh, definitely. I think that's the first step is to pay attention to what's going on out there and to listen to the women, to go out and ask questions. I think it's been such a hidden topic for so long, most people don't even know it's happening. And then the people who are paying attention, as you pointed out, is still trying to get a handle on how big the problem is. I think raising awareness is the first step.
Bill Tamayo joins us now. You heard a brief excerpt from his comments that are part of the Rape in the Fields documentary. He is an attorney with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission and has focused on this question in particular. Bill Tamayo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
What can the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission do in this regard? Because as we've just been discussing, it's very difficult to take these cases, make these cases stick at the criminal level. What have you been able to do in terms of the actions that you've taken, and describe how you, in fact, make the employer the target of what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is the federal agency charged with investigating employment discrimination claims and, if necessary, litigating them in federal court. The principal statute that we enforce is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the courts have interpreted that law to also prohibit sexual harassment. So what the EEOC can do is investigate cases, talk to witnesses, talk to various claimants, and try to see who are the victims here. And if we believe a violation has occurred, we'll make that finding and invite the employer to work out a confidential settlement with us. If that doesn't work out, then the case comes to me as the regional attorney, and I will decide whether we should sue the company for sexual harassment. And the purpose of the lawsuit is twofold. One is to get money for the victims of harassment, which may include back pay if they were, they lost their job or were demoted, could include compensatory damages for their pain and suffering, and if necessary, it can include punitive damages to be able to punish a company for their behavior.
And how difficult are these cases to win? We see in the film examples of both cases where there were judgments secured, one you were involved in with Harris Ranch in California. But we also see cases where nothing comes from this. Are these particularly difficult cases?
Well, I think every employment discrimination case is difficult. We have to convince either the court or the jury that a violation has actually occurred. Our test is not like criminal prosecutors where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Ours is what they call preponderance of the evidence, basically 51%, that they reasonably believe a violation has occurred here. So it's not that hard in that the standard is a little bit lower. But as Andres pointed out earlier, we have situations where people may be first reluctant to come forward anyway to tell their story. And much less stay along with the case, over a number of years. I should say the Harris Farms case started out, the rapes were in the early 90s. She filed a charge with the commission in 1999. We filed a lawsuit in 2002. It goes to trial in 2004. We get a verdict in 2005. And then the company appeals, and we went on appeal in 2008. So it was a long case. And so it is difficult because the women, the victims, have to stay through a long ordeal. But we were able to obtain, many cases don't go to trial. We obtained significant settlements short of trial, like the DaCosta Farms case, the Tanamura case, and other cases that we'll be talking about tonight.
One of the most interesting moments in the film, Andres Cedilla, happens in the aftermath of the Harris Farms case. You have a crew that goes down and finds the alleged perpetrator of these incidents. Somehow, whoever shot that manages to get this person to actually do the interview, which is extraordinary in and of itself. And it's very revealing because, again, in an odd way of what's not said. The question is asked, did you rape these women? And you have a long silence. And eventually the response is, well, you know, these things.
Yeah, we were very fortunate to have a great crew to go down to McAllen, Texas for us and find Rene Rodriguez, who was accused of raping Olivia Tamayo in the Harris Farms case. And, you know, he never had a criminal charge brought against him. He was a free man, despite the fact that there was, in a civil court, found damages for Olivia against Harris Farms. And he was, you know, living in his house, minding his own business. And our crew was able to go and speak with him. And he had a hard time answering the basic question. He maintained that the relationship was consensual, which he did the whole time. And we're back to the same standard of proof. You know, he said, she said, and there was no other evidence.
I want to ask all three of you if there is something, and we'll have to continue this conversation after our break, which we're coming up on. But Bernice Jurink, start us out on this, because it raises this interesting question of whether there is something peculiar about this particular enterprise, agriculture. In the review of your program in the New York Times, the reviewer makes the comment that agriculture is sort of perfectly situated for this sort of behavior to take place because it's its own little kingdom. Is that what you found? Is there something peculiar and unique that allows this problem to fester within the world of agriculture?
We have heard from farm worker advocates who describe this scenario as creating an environment that's perfect for victimization because the power imbalance is so great between the supervisors and the workers. Often what you have are supervisors who are bilingual, who can kind of serve as an intermediary between the grower, the business owner, and the monolingual seasonal and migrant worker. And so if that supervisor wants to really abuse that power, the power of language and the power of their position, they're very well situated.
Would you concur with that, Bill Tamayo, just briefly, and then we'll continue our conversation, that this is a particularly dark and difficult employment arena?
I think it's a difficult arena. It's our nation's roots are economically are rooted in slavery, in agricultural industry and slavery. That's not to say that all, you know, parts of the industry now conduct their business terribly, but the power imbalance that has ruled that industry still continues to the present, and the vulnerability of the workers just enhances the imbalance of power. But if you would look at the military scandal, sex scandal, that is being debated every day in Congress these days, that kind of illustrates the problem, you know, where there's this power imbalance and women are scared to come forward. And we're talking U.S. citizen, largely white, English-speaking, educated women who are victims of sexual assault and are scared to come forward.
And let me hold you there as we go to our break. We'll pick up this conversation. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic. If you have been involved in farm work yourself or are a farmer, we'd love to hear from you in particular. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. In today for Michael Krasny, our topic this hour, the documentary, Rape in the Fields. It will air tonight at 10 on KQED 9. It will air tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on Univision. The film is a collaboration between Univision, Frontline, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the Investigative Reporting Program at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We'd like your participation in our program as part of our collaborative conversation. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. One listener writes in this, One shameful aspect of this problem is the tolerance of our government for illegal immigration. With a visa and legal authorization to work, a worker has some basic protection. Lacking legal status puts the worker in an indentured servitude status. Bernice Jung, this is, of course, a week when a lot of focus is on immigration reform. Senate is poised to vote on a bill. Is there anything within the current legislation that would alter at all the rights that undocumented workers would have?
There is a provision in the Senate version of the bill that would provide greater protections to workers who come forward with concerns about workplace conditions. It's not specifically targeted at farm workers or agricultural workers, but there is one aspect of that provision that seems like it might have applied to the DeCoster situation that we were talking about earlier, where if there is some kind of immigration raid or some kind of regulatory presence at a business, that they would confer with different agencies, including the Department of Labor and others, to see if there are potential abuses taking place at that operation.
Which really raises this central question that you raise in the film. Lowell Bergman, the correspondent and narrator of the film, says at one point that there's this fundamental question about whether or not, as a government, we're going to treat people who have been abused as victims or as criminals.
I mean, that is one of the central questions. I mean, that was referring specifically to the Postville raid in Iowa for 2008. It was the largest single-site immigration raid in U.S. history, in which they deported very quickly 300 people, you know, separated them from their families, and never stopped to ask them if they had been victims of abuse. And, of course, at the same time, what came out from all this is that there was dozens of women who were being harassed, assaulted, and or raped at the facility. But they weren't concerned with that, and they were deported as criminals, along with the perpetrators who were also deported. So the question then becomes, and since then the Obama administration has gone on to deport record numbers of people. And so when you're going in, the people who are working in these plants or in the fields may not have legal work papers, but they are workers here. And whether you're documented or not, you are protected by the laws of this country, whether they're criminal laws or Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Those laws apply to you whether you are here legally or not. But when the government puts a priority on deporting the people, victims and criminals often are getting deported altogether on the same bus.
Bill Tamayo, what's your perspective on that issue?
Well, I think immigration status is clearly a question here, and whether it's used as a weapon against the employees is a crucial question. I think that's what many advocates observe, and that's come up in several of our cases. But I also point out that in two of the key cases, Harris Farms, where we got a nearly $1 million verdict, and Tonnemore and Antle, which settled for almost $2 million, immigration status was not an issue. In Harris Farms, it was a threat to kill Olivia's husband if she ever reported the rapes. Tonnemore and Antle is the classic quid pro quo. You want to eat? This is what you got to do. And in a case we litigate out of Oregon, Willamette Tree, the perpetrator put shears to the throat of the victim and said, if you ever report these rapes, I'm going to kill you and your family. So, I mean, we're also talking about the threat of violence or actual, you know, really threats of really hard physical violence that I think is a critical factor that plays into several of the cases that we've litigated.
And but again, what is so striking is that it's not the individual who said that, if you report this, I'm going to kill you, who was punished, right? It was that person's employer.
Well, the law says that Title VII, we go after the employer because the employer is the person, one, who can pay out, but number two, the employer controls the conditions of work to make sure that it's a safe place. And if their supervisors are harassing women, then the company is going to have to be held accountable for it.
And describe that environment, if you would, Bernice Jung or Andra Sedulia, both, about what takes place there? How is it possible for employers in these various situations to say, I know nothing, essentially?
Well, I mean, that's a tough one. I think, you know, we had a difficult time getting representatives of the agricultural industry to go on the record.
You actually don't. I don't think there's a single interview in the film, is there, of an actual agricultural employer. There's representatives, there's attorneys for them, but you couldn't get anyone to really go on camera.
That's correct. We didn't get any in the film, we don't have any actual farmers on camera, but we do have representatives of the agricultural industry. And I think in fairness to their position, they want a safe workplace for their workers. They want their workers to be happy and healthy, and they don't want to see them to get deported either because they rely on that labor. And we see in California, there are sexual harassment trainings that are required for employers to give their supervisors. So there are steps that are being made to start to address this problem. That being said, when we talk to growers, they had a very hard time admitting that this was a problem or a big problem at all. There was a big disconnect between what we were hearing in the fields and what we were hearing from the employers.
Is there a race part of this, Bernice Yearng, in that all of the victims, at least as I recall in the film, and speak to this from your reporting too, are Latina, and the alleged perpetrators are Latino. Is this something that is not believed or taken as seriously, perhaps, because it is of that culture?
Well, I think that when you look at who's working in the agricultural industry, it is primarily folks from Mexico and Central America. So I think we're just looking at this particular demographic in particular, and that's why the number of the victims and the perpetrators, alleged perpetrators in these cases, are of Latino background. Of course, this happens in any industry and of any background. But in terms of whether these women are believed or whether the stories are heard, I think the agricultural industry as a whole is unseen often.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you have these really stark conditions that they're laboring under, you know, it doesn't start or stop with sexual assault. There are also issues with heat illness, with access to water, with wage and hour, etc. So I think it's the whole entire industry flies under the radar to some certain extent.
Which, add to that, if you would, Bill Tamayo, is this something that is sort of easy not to pay attention to, either because it's an invisible industry, as Bernice Yearng suggests, or because there are people who largely don't speak English, that we can that it's easier to sort of not hear those stories, take those problems as seriously?
Well, I think partly it's also the geographic isolation, the cultural isolation, and the linguistic isolation of the workers from the owners. And I really put the onus on the owners because these are their farms. I assume that if they would be concerned about fires going on different of the properties, that they would, you know, want to take care of that, or wanting workers to know about OSHA violations, things like that, so that it could be reported quickly. I would like them to look at sexual harassment the same way, that it's an important issue that they have to address, and consequently they have to take all those necessary steps, you know, make sure materials are bilingual, make sure there's training of supervisors, and if supervisors violate policies, that they're punished for it.
Bill Tamayo, regional attorney for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, joining us along with Bernice Yearng and Idris Cedillo, who worked on the film that will be broadcast tonight at 9 o'clock, or 10 o'clock rather, on KQED 9. It will air at 7 o'clock on Saturday at Univision. We should also mention that KQED's California Report will be airing a 4-part series on this topic starting tomorrow. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. One of our listeners writes, rape is horrible, but what about the human trafficking issue? Is it not the case that illegal farm workers are often shuttled between fields around the United States? Where there is smoke, there is fire. And I suspect that rape is but one symptom of larger organized criminal activities.
Well, we definitely found that to be true. There was lots of parallels with human trafficking. In some cases, the two issues overlap. I mean, to use DeCoster as an example, these were women who had been smuggled from their villages in rural Mexico, and their smugglers were in contact, or in some cases, their very same supervisors. So when they're threatening them, with sexual assault, they're also saying, we know where you live. We know how to get to your family. Don't ever report this. And they're basically being held captive in the place of their work. So whether that falls under the legal definitions of human trafficking, it depends on certain conditions. But in effect, that's what's happening.
And what about this connection to other criminal activity? Robert Reich, and the former Clinton labor secretary, now at UC Berkeley, makes the point in the film that in some of these places, this goes hand in hand with a variety of other workplace violations. Is there a sort of smoke, there's fire sort of connectivity to various workplace problems?
I mean, I think that's true with any organization or any company. So, I mean, again, there's employers out there who are doing a great job, who follow the law, who are taking care of their workers. I think it's when the management is not paying attention, they're relying on, in this case, there's a lot of, there's intermediaries between the growers and the workers in terms of farm labor contractors. So they're able to contract out the employment to another agency and have a level of deniability there of what's going on.
I want to play one more clip from the film. This is with Congressman Luis Gutierrez of Illinois, and it's an exchange between correspondent Lowell Bergman and Congressman Gutierrez, and it's over this fundamental question of belief, because there is so little in the way of evidence that is often can be documented and proven. So let's listen to this excerpt with Congressman Gutierrez.
Representatives of agribusiness say to us, yes, there's sexual harassment in our industry, but it's no different than the rest of America. And what we find is there are no statistics. So what evidence do you have?
The personal testimony of those women that I've met with, the tears in their eyes, the anguish in their face, the humiliation. You can say that my information is simply anecdotal. But when the same information repeats itself, the stories I've heard on my travels throughout the United States are the same. And you want to know something? I learned a long time ago that when it comes to these situations, believe the women. Believe the women.
An excerpt from tonight's film, Rape in the Fields. How did those stories affect you, Bernice Yearing, when you heard them? Did you have that same similar experience, believe the women?
You know, I mean, you approach it as a reporter and you have to be skeptical of everything you're hearing and you can't take anything at face value. When you start to dig under the surface and you start to hear the same thing, again, from multiple sources, from different places across the country, from people who don't know each other, have no way of communicating with each other, you begin to have an openness to what these stories are, and you realize that there's not a lot of reason for them mm-hmm. to make up these stories. I mean, there are instances in some of the cases that we've looked at where attorneys for the companies have argued that the women are making up these stories for financial gain or for a special visa that would allow them to stay in the country. And while that is always possible, and it's always possible that some of the women are fabricating or exaggerating, I also have a very difficult time believing that so many women would come forward and lay out some very personal material and details and basically subject themselves to this kind of public scrutiny. It just tips it in the favor of the women for me.
Bernice Yearing works with the Center for Investigative Reporting and also on this film. How did these interviews affect you, Andres?
Yeah, I was asked this question earlier, and I think one of the ways that you approach, I mean, you can't help but be affected by the stories that you hear. And I think it's, you know, you should be affected by it when you hear the emotional retelling of some of this trauma. But as Bernice said, you have to approach it as your job as a journalist. It's, you know, you're like a firefighter or a police officer. You have a job to do. I think I was most impacted by the courage of the women to come forward who decided to risk it all and put their faces on camera, their reputations, their jobs, in some cases, their immigration status, to be able to tell a story. And when I asked them, why are you telling this story? The answer was, because I know this isn't just happening to me. I know this is happening to other women. I want them to know that they can speak out, that they can have the courage, and they don't have to just take it.
Let's take a call. Burgess in San Francisco joins us. Burgess, go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to share a quick story. In February 2nd, 2002, there was a video game publisher in San Francisco that fired all their Filipinos on the same day. And I can't imagine what these women are going through, but all of us felt very powerless. We felt very irrelevant. We felt very, very distraught. We were lost, and we didn't want to share our story. We didn't want to talk to anyone, but at the same time, we wanted to do something. And Bill Tamayo's group at the EEOC, they were the ones that listened to us, and they were the ones that reassured us the whole time. And it's finding a partner, someone that can take your hand and hold you through and say, you know, what you did here isn't your fault, and it's important that you talk about it, was very helpful. It was scary for everyone because we didn't know what we were going to do, but the EEOC and Bill Tamayo, they really helped us through that. And I can't imagine what these women are going through, but if any of them is listening to your program right now, there are people out there that can help and can let you know what's going on and how to proceed forward.
Burgess, thanks. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. Bill Tamayo, to you on this, how do you sort of filter and listen? What do you draw upon when you're hearing a story, whether it's one that Burgess just told, which apparently you have dealt with in the past, or these other stories that Bernice and Andres have documented in this film?
Well, I think from a personal level, having had dealt with a lot of domestic violence cases of women who were threatened with deportation by their batterer husbands, so I've seen that. I've represented people through political asylum proceedings who had been tortured. These cases kind of follow that genre, or whatever you want to call it, of situations where people abuse because of power. And I think the difficulty is hearing these stories is that the same abuses still continue, despite the fact that we have laws against this kind of behavior. But what perpetrators and I think some employers do is try to make sure the women never have access to the laws, never have access to the lawyers or advocates who can help them. But I feel like at the EEOC, our job is to make ourselves relevant and meaningful to some of the most vulnerable workers in the United States, which could be farm workers, people in the service industry, janitors, etc. And I feel very encouraged. I feel very, I take a lot of strength from the women because they are the ones who are brave and they come forward to tell their story. And then my job and our staff's job is to try to make sure that they have access to these laws and that we can try to get justice for them.
Ed writes in this comment, which tries to get at some of the layers involved in this. He says, how is this situation complicated by the employment setups at many of these fields? Aren't many of the fruit and vegetable pickers hired by a subcontractor who is independent of the growers? I wonder if there aren't several layers going on here.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we've found. I mean, more and more, especially in California, you have what are called farm labor contractors, which a grower will then hire to provide the workforce. A lot of times the workers don't even know who they're working for. They've never met the grower. They don't know who the company is. So if there is a problem, they don't know. There may not be an HR department. They don't know where the main office is. They were picked up in a pickup truck and they were dumped in a field and they get a check and they don't know who it's from. And so it creates a barrier for the worker to actually report. And then for the grower, they have a level of deniability that they weren't the ones that hired the workers. It was the farm labor contractors. So it creates a difficult situation.
Human Rights Watch put out a report about this. But even within their report, there's this caveat, which I just want to read, which is, while the exact prevalence of workplace sexual violence and harassment among farm workers is difficult to determine due to the challenges of a seasonal migrant population, the problem is serious. It's it's kind of a nothing statement, to tell you the truth, right, Bernice Yearring? I mean, it's evidence of how difficult it is that even Human Rights Watch says, well, this is really difficult, and but it's a problem.
That was one of the largest challenges to our reporting, was trying to pinpoint the scope of this issue. I think that essentially when you don't even know exactly how many farm workers there are in this country, right now we're working off of estimates from the Department of Labor, it's impossible to then know how many women might be or men are experiencing this kind of situation. We do know, as Andres mentioned earlier, that 2/3 of sexual assault and rape is not reported to the authorities, and it's even less likely for immigrant and undocumented immigrants to step forward. So, it's not something that is very easily, determinable. But there have been some small studies that have looked at, populations of farm workers in California and also in meat processing plants in Iowa. And as many as 80% report having been sexually harassed at work.
I want to spend our last few minutes talking about the significance of this story within the wider realm of the food on our tables and the role that the undocumented play in providing what we all consume. Your documentary made me think about a film I'm sure you're all familiar with that aired over 50 years ago, and that's Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame. And in that famous, famous film, he writes, they are the forgotten people, the undereducated, the underfed. They are the migrants, workers in the sweatshops of the soil, the harvest of shame. That was 53 years ago. You could have had that line in your film, Andres.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I was shocked, actually. On the very basic reporting level, you're trying to set up interviews with people, and you realize it's very hard to schedule an interview because they're up sometimes 3-4 in the morning working 12, 14-hour days. We're meeting people who have double shifts and are working the night shift as well. They're toiling in the sun, often in very cold conditions. It's extremely hard work. And one of the things that since I've worked on this documentary, when I see the food on my plate, I'm realizing that there's not a piece of food on my plate that wasn't touched somehow by an undocumented worker, whether it was raising the chickens, processing the eggs, any of the fruit and vegetables, the quality inspection. All that process is being done mostly by undocumented workers.
Bill Tamayo, your thoughts on that?
Well, I feel like we're scratching the surface of a problem that is wide and deep. And it's unfortunate that, yeah, that same quote could be used today. But I also know that the industry opposed many laws that were going to give rights to workers. And one of the major ones was the National Labor Relations Act, which allowed workers to unionize in 1935. But Southern congressmen on behalf of the growers opposed it, and now it doesn't. So it doesn't apply to agricultural workers because they didn't want black workers, agricultural workers, to have the same rights as white workers, and they also got exemptions from the Fair Labor Standards Act. But Title VII applies to all workers, regardless of immigration status, and our goal now is to make sure that workers have full access to these laws so that we don't have to keep hearing that quote and say that, oh, that still applies today.
Bernice Yearring, one of our listeners writes in and saying, what can consumers do to help? Your thoughts on that, as well as our general awareness of the role that undocumented workers play in our lives?
That's a really challenging question. It's a question that we've discussed within the reporting team quite a bit in terms of, what are organizations doing to resolve this issue? And I spoke to a researcher who said that, really one first step is just engaging with your grower, the farmer's market, really just becoming aware of these conditions. That's step number one. Probably not a totally satisfying answer to some degree. But there have been some really interesting attempts at addressing this more systematically in Florida, where an organization has essentially introduced what is called a fair food program. So they work directly with the buyers of produce to make sure that all of the produce that's cultivated by certain growers passes a certain kind of fair labor muster, and that includes ensuring that it's a place free of sexual harassment. They bring in independent auditors, so to speak, to the fields to actually survey and make sure that things are on the up and up. And I think that it's a really interesting model.
Let's squeeze in one last call from Tom in Oakland, who wants to make an interesting point. Just briefly, if you would, Tom, please.
Yeah, good morning. What your guest said kind of made me think about how hiring practices using third-party human suppliers and traffickers is also reminiscent of how high-tech companies in the U.S. Hire third-party, such as South Korean labor source companies that hire other laborers in Cambodia or China or Burma and the like, and that way they're immune from the abuses that go on. And that kind of, in a way, almost makes straight slavery, where the master knows the owner, the masters know the slaves directly by face, like Jefferson did, almost, I'm being ironic here, almost kind of wistful, you know.
All right, Tom, thank you. Thanks for that observation. Last quick thoughts from each of you on what you hope people gain from this this important film. Andres?
Well, you know, I think, it's just paying a little more attention to where your food comes from, paying a little more attention to the fact that, it comes from people who are working hard, and what is their relationship to this country and what their rights are here.
Bill Tamayo.
I'm hoping that the growers, the agricultural industries, step up. It's up to them. And I think we've seen some signs. Mike Antle, vice president of Tanamura and Antle, at our press conference said, look, we want to set a new tone in the industry where women can come forward and complain without fear of retaliation.
And let me hold you there so I can get a last thought from Bernice Uring.
I think that it's important for the women to feel empowered to come forward with these complaints, and I think it's also important for the agricultural industry to take these issues seriously.
Thanks all very much for your work and for putting this film forward for all of us to consume. Thank you all. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.